I just want to read the beginning of the 11th chapter of the letter to the Romans that David read from, with this great kind of explosion of the mystery of the wonders of God's knowledge. As I said last week, the 9th, 10th, and 11th chapters of the letter to the Romans are extremely important because in it, Paul is agonizing over the fact that not all Jews have seen in Jesus the fulfillment of all things Jewish. And he begins, I ask then, has God rejected his people, his fellow Jews? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people, whom he foreknew. And then it goes on. And he bursts into that kind of great explosion of wonderment at the end of that chapter, because he can't figure out how God is working this thing out with the other Jews who have not accepted Jesus. But please note that Paul said that God does not revoke his call to the Jews. Full stop. We Christians, of course, have denied that for 2,000 years. This is not the case. Okay, to the gospel. When I was in the seminary, we spent hours on this text. It's the only biblical text that I can cite by number, chapter and verse. Matthew 16:19. You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, blah, 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 blah. And we did it, of course, in very conscious opposition to the Protestants, who were in those days known as heretics, who did not accept the primacy of Peter as it was experienced in the Roman Church. So often happens, they say no, we say yes, and they say no in an excessive way, and we say yes in an excessive way. We're still living in those excesses. The other thing that is interesting is that it was years before, when I was reading the Gospel of Matthew, it twigged on me that also in the Gospel of Matthew are two other passages, which we never talked about in the seminary, that the power to bind and loose was given to the entire church, to the entire community. And then that other very, very famous passage, which we never even addressed. Call no one father, because you are all equals. Call no one teacher, because you are all equals. Then finally, we conveniently forget what follows from this very passage I read today, that Jesus immediately after this said, and I'm going to be killed. And Peter becomes outraged and in the strongest possible term remonstrates with Jesus. No, this will not happen. Peter rebuked Jesus. Of course, Jesus' response was, get behind me, Satan. We never talked about that part of the passage. So what's going on here? A very selective reading of Scripture. Let me read you, finally, part of a letter that was written by Dr. Eamon Duffy, great church historian at Cambridge. He was writing in response to a review of a book by Ian Kerr, a Dominican theologian who teaches at Oxford. Kerr had written an enormous biography of Cardinal Newman, in which he said that Newman was very subservient in his understanding of the relationship between theologians and the papacy. But if you'll be patient, I'm going to read the whole letter. It's not all that long. He and Kerr rightly points out that there is more to be said on Newman's views on the relationship between theology and authority than I was able to deal with in my Durham lessons. The University of Durham had a series of lectures Duffy gave. But Newman's attitude to magisterial interventions were not were a good deal less cheerfully docile than Father Kerr seems to imply. Remember, Newman was part of the First Vatican Council and a very reluctant participant when it came to the definition of papal infallibility, because he thought it was a bad idea. As a Catholic, Newman, of course, believed that the hierarchy had the right and sometimes the duty to decide contested theological questions. But he also insisted that there was an inevitable and healthy tension in the church between authority and intellect. Forces, quoting, so independent of each other, so divergent, and so conflicting. Those are Newman's words. He believed that understanding of the faith was necessarily advanced, again, Newman, by the collision of Catholic intellects with Catholic intellects. And he repeatedly lamented the trigger happiness of the magisterium of his own day. This was 150 years ago. Which denied theology its legitimate freedom. So he wrote in 1863, quote, the age of the church is peculiar. In former times, there was not the extreme centralization which is now in use. If a private theologian said anything, another answered him. If the controversy grew, then it went to a bishop, a theological faculty, or to some foreign university. The Holy See was but the court of ultimate appeal. Now, if I, as a private priest, put anything in print, Rome answers me at once. How can I fight with such a chain on my arm? There was true private judgment in the primitive and medieval schools. There are no schools now, no freedom of opinion, that is, no exercise of the intellect. Newman believed that this was, quote, a way of things which in God's own time will work its own cure. And Duffy concludes, we wait in hope. Well, several things. The centralization that Newman complained about in 1863 has grown exponentially. Till today. The great Bernard Herring, 40 years ago, talked about creeping infallibility. He said, it's not creeping, it's galloping infallibility. So what we're talking about, of course, is what does it mean to be the Pope today? How is the papal office, what is the papal office, and how is it to be exercised? On Christmas Day in 1995, John Paul II himself issued an encyclical letter called Ut Unum Sint, that may all be one, adverting, of course, to the great final passage of the Gospel of John. And in the course of that letter, he said, I need help in discerning the shape of the papacy in the 21st century. To my knowledge, not a single Catholic responded to that plea by the Pope. A number of Anglican divines did. But the Curia, of course, was horrified. And nothing came of it. Although in the letter, John Paul apologizes for the sinfulness of the Roman Church, its intolerance, his need to be open to other Christian churches. So where are we today? Okay, the present Pope refuses to even admit, as the Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council did, that other churches are real churches, that God is active with the Lutherans and the Methodists, etc., etc., etc. He won't call them churches anymore. And Gill was present when Ratzinger gave a notorious talk at the University of Toronto years ago, when he was still just Cardinal Prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. Our whole department went. It was an enormous event. They moved it from the auditorium at the U of T to the hockey rink, which was filled. The last words of that talk were these. Ratzinger said, there's a cathedral in Germany with a statue. The statue is of a hound, of a stag, rather, surrounded by hounds attacking it. You remember that? The church is the stag, and the hounds are the theologians. In that book of Matthew Fox that I've mentioned several times, he lists 100 theologians that the present pope has silenced or driven out of the church. All of them, what we call liberal. A great number of liberation theologians, the group that I know best. On the other hand, he's admitted, of course, all the misogynistic, homophobic Anglicans in the world to a special place in the Roman Church if they want to come. And they've come, whole parishes, several bishops. He called back the people of Archbishop Lefebvre, officially excommunicated by John Paul II because of their denial of the Second Vatican Council, which they said was the devil's work. So what does the papacy look like? What is the papacy supposed to be? Over centuries, it's changed massively. It is supposed to be a center of unity. That's the classic definition of what the Bishop of Rome is supposed to be doing. Inviting everybody. As I said last week, this makes Benedict's avowed intention to create a smaller, purer church even more mystifying. One of the early fathers talked about the Bishop of Rome and said, well, we ought to acknowledge the Bishop of Rome, propter principaliorum caritatem, because out of Rome comes a greater, more amplified charity, love. Folks, the simple fact is that's not what we have today. Although Benedict will say, I do not want to be the church of no, that's precisely what he is. He is the church of no. No! No! He is not supposed to be an autocrat, which is in fact exactly how he is behaving. I talked last week about the new translation of the liturgy, which he, overriding all of the episcopal conferences of the English-speaking world, is going to impose on all of us come the first Sunday of Advent of this year. I just got a book from Cambridge University Press, The Crisis of Authority in Catholic Modernism. We do have a crisis of authority. But it's not a crisis precipitated by a bunch of rebels. It's a crisis that finds its location in the very word that Newman used 150 years ago for the centralization of authority in the church, which has only grown in those 150 years. I mean, the historical record is clear. I'm not making this up. I have no vituperative intention against this German. But the fact is, we have to look at what he's doing, what the Gospels call for, and to ask, what in God's name is going on here? What have we come to? Where one man determines everything. I still find myself aghast at the great public debate between Cardinal Schönbrunn, this was about a year ago, Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna, and one of the Vatican bureaucrats, Sodano, I believe, Secretary of State. And Schönbrunn criticized Sodano, who had been continuously accusing the anti-Catholic press of magnifying the pedophile thing. And the Pope intervenes all by himself and says, only the Pope can criticize a cardinal. No cardinal can publicly disagree with another cardinal. So, the question is, where are we? What have we come to? Above all, what does it mean to be faithful to the intention of Jesus? The man for all others.